Welcome to the Nerd Party.
Welcome to Missing Frames. This is the podcast where we watch movies we probably should have seen by this point in our lives. I'm your host, Sean Eastridge. This is a historic episode. It's the 30th Missing Frames, which is very exciting, and I am very excited to have none other than Mr. Brad Gullickson for his first ever Missing Frames appearance on the show today. How are you, good sir?
I am doing great. Thank you for having me, especially on such a historic episode.
I know. Well, I feel like a historic episode, we need a historic co-host, and I'm glad you could come in and do it. I'm very excited. Thank you so much for doing it.
You're quite welcome.
So we are going to be doing a movie that I have never seen. I don't know how I've never gotten around to seeing it, but sadly, that's the case. But it is going to be Dirty Harry. Like I said, I don't know how I haven't seen it. I don't have any anger or unbridled hatred or unjustified hatred for this movie. I just have never gotten around to it. I do have the Blu-ray. I got the Blu-ray a while ago. I do this thing where I buy movies and then never watch them. Do you? Is this something that has happened to you before?
Oh, most definitely. I'm staring at a stack of Blu-rays that I have not watched in over a year. So, yeah.
Well,
I have a problem as well.
Well, as long as you've watched them, though, at some point. You bought them and you watched them?
No, not this one pile I'm looking at. What I do is I'll have a pile by my TV of my most recently purchased Blu-rays, and currently it's about 2 feet tall, and it contains Criterion discs that I have not watched that I purchased in the Barnes & Noble sale like 2 years ago.
That's amazing.
So, yeah.
I have those too. I know all of it. So see, we can relate and we can understand and we're going to get through this together. But the important thing is by watching this, I feel like I can at least knock one off the list. But before we get too much into Dirty Harry, I want to talk a little bit about the Nerd Party, which is the network that Missing Frames is a part of. It's just a whole bunch of awesome podcasts you can check out at thenerdparty.com. We've got all kinds of amazing stuff. There's a new Doctor Who podcast called Time and Space, which is great because everyone loves Doctor Who except Brad.
That's correct. I do not care about Doctor Who.
But that's okay because we still love Brad regardless and we still love Doctor Who regardless. So check that out. You can follow the Nerd Party at Join Nerd Party. You can like us on Facebook. And I highly recommend that. And something else I'd highly recommend is that, Brad, you have a podcast as well, don't you?
I sure do. The In the Mouth of Dorkness podcast.
And that is a fantastic podcast. And where can people find that and listen to that?
Oh, you can find it on Apple Podcasts. You can find it on Podbean, YouTube, various other locations.
All over the globe.
Yes.
It's everywhere. There's no excuse to not find it and listen to it because there's not a single place you can go where it doesn't exist.
That's a fact.
Is it a fact, though? I don't know.
No, it's not at all.
But that's all right. And you guys have a ton of awesome stuff coming up. It might already, just because by the time this episode airs, you may already have this, but I know you've got a lot of really cool stuff on the docket. I know you have an interview with Greg Sestero coming up. That's, yes, the Greg Sestero from The Room talking about The Disaster Artist. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, he'll be returning to the podcast. We talked to him last year before The Disaster Artist came out, and now it's time for a post-Disaster Artist conversation. I want to get into the Golden Globes.
Who doesn't? But there you go. So people can go back and listen to that first episode to prep themselves for this new one.
Yeah, and it was a pretty good conversation then, and we've become pretty chummy since then. So I'm really excited for this next conversation. So it should drop at the end of January.
Awesome. Awesome. So that is that. And let's get to talking about this movie, Dirty Harry. So I will tell you what I know about it, which is next to nothing. I was telling you, we were talking about this, and I said, I know that there's a, you know, the
well, we were talking about the make my day quote, which actually doesn't come from Dirty Harry. It comes from
right,
Magnum
make,
Force.
That's right. Do you feel lucky, punk? Make my day. Or is it, well, does he say, do you feel lucky in this movie?
Yeah, the lucky punk speech happens in Dirty Harry. Make my okay. day is in the next film, and the Deadpool
gotcha.
Has the classic line, you're shit out of luck.
So there's no shortage of fantastic one-liners in this series is what you're telling me.
Correct.
See, I almost regret not buying the box set. When I got Dirty Harry, there was a moment where I almost got the entire set, but I was like, I need to hold off and wait.
I
and
mean,
see.
You know, I love all five films, but it does adhere to the law of diminishing returns. Dirty Harry is by far the best film of the
okay.
bunch.
And Dirty Harry is one of your favorite movies, you were telling me?
Yeah, it's my 31st favorite movie of all time.
Yeah, so
actually.
get this. Brad has a one, or you're working on this.
I'm working on my top 100. I'm
top
at 100. 60.
That is absurd to me because I can barely, I have a top 10 and that's solid. But once I get past 10, I am like, I there are too many movies and I cannot, it's impossible.
It's a
so
fluid
I don't understand.
Thing. I mean, it changes. You know, my favorite film changed about 5 years ago. So every now and again, something new enters into the picture.
Okay. But Dirty Harry is the number 31.
Right.
That's a good spot to be in. That's
yeah.
like, that's fantastic.
It sits right between King Kong, the 33 original, and John McTiernan's 1987 classic Predator.
Right where it should be. And where's Peter Jackson's King Kong on this list?
Not on the 60 yet.
We'll get there eventually. But it's nice. So it's not, it would be great if Dirty Harry, can we, just for this episode, can we bump it up to number 30 on your list just to tie it in with the 30th Missing Frames episode, just for this episode?
Okay, fine, sure. Because you asked nicely.
Right. So how convenient. Wow, this is amazing that Dirty Harry happens to be your 30th favorite movie on the 30th episode of Missing Frames. This is just incredible. I think this is clearly a divine moment, destiny for certain. But yeah, so that is about it. I know Clint Eastwood is in this movie. I know he's like a cop. I know he's dirty. And I know his name is probably Harry.
Do you know the you don't know the plot? You don't know who the villain of the piece is?
I know next to nothing about this movie or any of these movies in the series.
Interesting. Well, this is exciting.
Yeah. Yeah. So what is your, so tell me a little bit about your history with this movie. When did you first see it? Like, did you see Dirty Harry first, or like, so just let me, what was your history with this film?
Well, actually the first Dirty Harry film I saw was the last one, The Deadpool. I saw it at my grandmother's house in England. We rented it from the local corner store, and I just needed more of that scumbag hunting thrill. So when we got back to the States, I made my mom rent all of the Dirty Harry films from our local Hollywood video, or maybe it was video library at the time. I was about 11 or 12 when I watched these films initially.
And she was like, yeah, totally. R-rated. Why not?
My parents were pretty cool. Once I broke the Rambo seal, they pretty much let me watch anything as long as I talked to them about it. I had to justify the plots of these films to my dad so that they weren't just gratuitous junk in my brain.
That's pretty fantastic. So you saw these young, you were young when you saw them. You've grown up with them. There's some nostalgia tied into that.
Certainly. I would say, though, that Dirty Harry didn't rank as one of my all-time favorite films until about 10 years ago when I rewatched it. And I'm struck by this balance of Clint Eastwood cool and right-wing insanity that is occurring in Dirty Harry.
Right.
I mean,
it's definitely more interesting considering the trajectory his career has taken lately.
Well, certainly. Yes, absolutely. And the less said about contemporary Clint Eastwood politics, the better. But I think they do kind of align with 1971's Clint Eastwood politics. Huh. I mean, Dirty Harry, when it was released, you know, Pauline Kael, she called it fascist. I think she actually wrote that it was a deeply immoral movie. It certainly ruffled a lot of feathers.
That sounds like exactly the kind of movie we should be watching for Missing Frames.
Well, yeah. So again, you know, it's 1971. It's a few years after the Miranda rights were established. Okay. And the conversation was that maybe we're spending too much time concerning ourselves with criminal rights and less time with victims' rights. And so here comes Dirty Harry to, you know, blast a few holes in the chests of punks.
It's just Raw Justice, which isn't that actually another movie? Isn't that a movie in the series?
I'm pretty
Raw
sure
Justice?
It definitely is.
It should be, yes. But that's fantastic. So it's like, as far as the political landscape goes, it's perfectly in tune with just the kind of like, we're fed up and we're not going to take anymore and we're going to take the law into our own hands kind of deal.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if you look at the people who were involved in this film on the screenplay front, you know, John Milius took a stab at this, the guy who brought us Conan the Barbarian, and he injected, you know, what he claims to have injected was this idea of two killers on the streets. There's the serial killer played by Andrew Robinson, and then there is the cop killer played by Clint Eastwood.
Okay. This is sounding very intense. Well, it's sounding very complicated.
Well, it has a lot of history to it, right? You know, it is inspired by the Zodiac killings of the late 1960s that were never solved. Scorpio is a direct reference to Zodiac. There's a plot point at the end that very much ties into something that the Zodiac threatened back in the 60s.
And where was this in Clint Eastwood's? So he'd done the Leone Westerns.
Yes. He'd actually made, let's see, three other films with its director, Don Siegel. They did The Beguiled, Two Mules for Sister Sarah, and Coogan's Bluff together. Before.
Now, were those Westerns?
Well, Two Mules for Sister Sarah was a Western, and The Beguiled...
I was gonna say, it has to be that one. That one sounds like it should be a Western.
Yeah, and you know, The Beguiled, they just remade it with Sofia Coppola this past year.
Oh, did they?
Yeah, but the Eastwood and Don Siegel version had a lot more machismo bullshit in it.
So was this like... was Dirty Harry kind of his? I know Good, the Bad, the Ugly was really popular with like film fanatics. I don't know. I can't recall if it was like quite a breakthrough hit at the time.
Well,
but was Dirty Harry kind of like that was basically what kind of threw him into the limelight for America?
Well, he was already a star by the time Dirty Harry came out, but it certainly escalated his spotlight. And it was a massive success. It was a huge, huge hit for the studio. But it was, you know, it made a statement. And obviously, you know, it spawned four more sequels well into the 90s.
That sounds awesome. Is there anything else I should know going into this as far as like, is there anything you want to say to prep me,
well,
to get me ready for
this? I always think it's interesting to look at the fringe universe in which other actors may have played this role. Originally, Irvin Kershner was set to direct, the guy who did Empire Strikes Back.
Yeah. Oh, wow.
And he had Frank Sinatra to play the lead.
Wow, that would have been very interesting.
Yeah, very different. And then, you know, Burt Lancaster was attached for a hot minute. He turned it down because he thought it was that the lines between cop and criminal blurred too much for him. There was too much gray. Steve McQueen turned it down because he didn't want to do another cop movie. Paul Newman turned it down because it was too right wing.
But Clint Eastwood was like perfect.
Yeah,
he's like, this is it.
Clint Eastwood wouldn't do it unless he had Don Siegel attached to direct. And Eastwood had just directed his directorial debut, Play Misty for Me, which came out the same year. And he does a little bit of directing on Dirty Harry as well. He shoots at least one scene in the movie.
And then as far, so when was the last time you watched this? Is this first viewing in a while, or?
I think I watched it in 2016 was probably the last time. I watch it about every other year.
Gotcha. Okay. So I'm genuinely excited to watch this. I mean, I know it's a classic, and I've just never, it's always nice to be able to knock a Blu-ray off my list of this ridiculous collection and stack that I've just never gotten around to watching. So I'm very excited. I would say I'm definitely looking forward to this, and I really hope I enjoy it. So let's just go and watch Dirty Harry, and we will be back to discuss.
Yes.
Now available to own on video cassette.
And we're back. We've watched Dirty Harry. Our lives have potentially been changed. And I'll go ahead and come out and say it, Brad. I really enjoyed this movie. I don't know if I loved it, but I did like it a lot, and I liked it enough to want to visit the future entries in the series.
Oh, that makes me so happy. And, you know, I don't think I was necessarily expecting you to love it right out of the gate. I think this is a movie that you come to love once you've processed it a few times. I watched it back to back just before we got on the phone here. And it's such a visceral experience. It's such a vicious movie. I was afraid that you could come down really harshly against this if you're not in the mood.
Well, it's tough because we talked about it a little bit before. We talked a little bit about the political angle of, especially in this day and age, how sensitive people are to certain topics and issues. And Dirty Harry is definitely a movie that came out well before people were flagging those kinds of things. And it was very interesting. It was very, like you were saying, it was very grungy. It didn't hold any punch, or didn't pull any punches. And it's interesting. I think I can't name another movie that depicts San Francisco as anything other than like sunny and happy. Like this was, I feel like this is the first time I've watched a movie or like a television show or anything where San Francisco, it's like grungy and it's nighttime. I mean, I have no doubt that is the reality, and I've just been watching too much Full House, but it was interesting. I realized as I was watching it, I was like, I don't think I've ever seen a movie depict San Francisco as anything other than like a sunny, bright, happy place to live.
Absolutely. I mean, Dirty Harry is an incredibly dark film visually. The cinematographer, Bruce Surtees, it lives in blackness, you know, those, and as the film progresses and Harry has to chase the Scorpio into the nighttime. I mean, there are that whole chase sequence through the city. You can't even see what's going on half of the time.
Oh, I know. But I love that. I love there's something about movies, certain movies from this time period, they were still transitioning out of the normal lighting. Set it, like, you know, you have your key light, your fill light. It was all like, you know, very clearly sets, very clearly well lit. They were kind of moving out of that in this era. So you can see that in this movie. And I mean, it would be also be with, I think, Gordon Willis. Is he the guy who did The Godfather? I'm pretty sure that's his name. You see him take that to its full fruition with The Godfather the following year. But I love anything that uses natural lighting, and I love watching older movies when you can sense the creative process and you can sense them making that effort. And probably part of it is just the fact that their budget was so low, but I do think that is really brilliant. And I love that kind of gritty cinematography. It really makes use of kind of making you feel like you're caught up in this really kind of nasty world and these kind of dark, disturbed politics and strange, like, it just, the atmosphere, it was perfect, and I really bought into it.
So what about Harry himself, Clint Eastwood's performance as well as the character?
I mean, it was so clearly, it's funny that you were saying they were looking at like Sinatra and other people for the role, because it feels so perfectly Eastwood to me. Like, it's kind of like how you hear about Tom Selleck was the first choice for Indiana Jones, but you cannot imagine anybody but Harrison Ford. It's the same thing here. It was like, oh, this is so perfect for Eastwood. Like, I remember when he it's very close to the opening, he goes into the mayor's office, and just that scowl, and the mayor says something to him, and he goes, oh, I'm sorry, are you guys gonna actually do your jobs, or something like that. And they're like, Callahan, you can't talk to him like that, he's the mayor. But I feel like, yes, he can. He's Clint Eastwood. He can talk however he wants to anybody. And that kind of attitude is what makes this character work.
Yeah. I mean, Eastwood is seriously cool, you know, just presentation-wise. He wears these incredibly cheap suits, but the way they fit his frame and the way he controls the space wherever he walks, you know, there's an undeniable attraction to just his level of command.
Yeah.
That, you know, in a real life scenario, you probably wouldn't want to, you know, have lunch with this guy. You certainly wouldn't want to talk politics with him. he is a monster, you know, that has been crushed by years of being in this system, and he is rebelling against this system. But damn it, if he doesn't look good chewing on a hot dog and firing a magnum one handed.
Oh, that was so perfect. I didn't realize that in that scene, that, which, you know, leads into the "Do you feel lucky, punk?" moment. I wrote this down. I was like, and he's chewing a hot dog. He's taking down robbers and just munching on a hot dog the entire time. I thought that perfectly, what a great introduction to that character. Because, you know, you've already established, like, oh yeah, he's cool, he's kind of dangerous. But that, to me, just perfectly represents how nonchalant he is about this. Like, it's like, this is just he's the blue collar cop, he's got to do his job, but he's gonna eat his hot dog while doing it, damn it. But yeah, to speak to your point, I mean, he's definitely I get where the anger is coming from, though, with his character. The whole idea, I it was very, because when he captures Scorpio, and I was like, oh, wait, man, there are 30 minutes left in this movie. What else is going to happen? And then it kicks off almost like, you know how Mad Max, the very last 20 minutes is basically the entire plot of the movie? That's almost like what it felt like with Dirty Harry, where it was like all of a sudden the last 30 minutes are a self-contained plot that you could use to summarize the entire movie, where it's basically, you know, Callahan feeling like slighted by the justice system and feeling like it is working against the people it's supposed to be protecting, takes the law into his own hands and decides to, you know, take out this guy.
Well, that's, I mean, he's broken by the DA's office, right? That moment, he's done, and now he's going to become, you know, Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Exactly. And, you know, as skewed as that might look in today's political landscape, the thing that worked about the movie is I bought into it, and I understood. I was like, okay, I see where this movie is going. This is totally like early 1970s justice taking the law into your own hands.
I mean, that's true, but it also ruffled a lot of feathers then. I mean, this was certainly seen as you know, the opposite of political correctness in 1971.
Right. Because anytime, and the movie is so violent. I mean, it really is. And I think a lot of it, you know, the politics of it, but also just the fact that he does not care. He doesn't care. Like, it's like he's blowing people away. He talks down a suicide by basically encouraging him not to, by saying, yeah, it looks disgusting when you, like, jump. Don't jump for all our sakes, because, like, it's a bloody mess. He basically forces the guy to almost throw up, and then the guy jumps at him, and he punches him in the face to knock him out. I was like, this is great. This is perfectly... this guy does not care. He does not care at all. And I can totally see how that kind of persona is not something that the general public would want to encourage or endorse.
Well, you know, I was thinking about the appeal of this character, and, you know, there's something obviously about action heroes, cinematic action heroes, that we all want to see them take the law into their own hands and do the right thing, which is apparently, you know, shooting a guy in the face because we know he's the bad guy. Yeah. But I was watching an interview with the actor Michael Madsen, and he said the appeal of Dirty Harry is that he's decisive and everybody likes decisiveness.
Yes.
And I think that ultimately is what I adore so much about the Dirty Harry character, is that sense of all-knowing and drive. That's and that's what Eastwood plays so perfectly throughout the first film.
Yeah, this is definitely the confirmation of his persona. Like, if the Leone movies were kind of like, here's the birth of a new kind of action hero, this feels like, all right, now it's cemented in the public eye. This is the way, this is a new kind of hero. And you can see the influence, just like the gruffness, the, like, I don't care, I'm going to do things my way. You see that in almost every single action movie that follows, and, like, the level of ridiculous violence, all kinds of stuff. So I have to say, one thing that caught me completely off guard about this movie that I absolutely adored was the soundtrack.
Yeah, Lalo Schifrin.
I was expecting like something more along the lines of like Die Hard, like these brass loud tones, like dun 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 dun. I wasn't expecting like funk, like soul music. That made me so like immediately I was into the movie, because it was just like you kick right in and it's just like, and I was like, is this Shaft? I feel like I'm watching Shaft. This is amazing. But I loved that it gives the film such an energy right from the get-go.
Well, Lalo Schifrin is one of my all-time favorite film composers.
What else has he done?
Well, he's most famous for the Mission Impossible theme.
Oh, yes! I knew I recognized his name. No wonder. No wonder I loved the soundtrack so much, because what a brilliant theme song that is.
And, you know, before this, I mean, he did do the score also to Bullet, the other famous San Francisco cop
movie. I have not seen.
Oh, well, we got to do that next
time. Future Missing Frames.
Yeah, he did the score for Enter the Dragon with Bruce Lee.
Okay.
He did the score for The Four Musketeers, which is another great one. Yeah, but he was all over the scene. He did a bunch of Charles Bronson movies, a bunch of Eastwood films.
Right.
Yeah. And it is absolutely fantastic, because it lulls you into the seedy nightlife of San Francisco, and it's kind of like this interesting mix between the worlds of Scorpio and Eastwood. It can be the ugliness of Scorpio's life, and it can be the loneliness of Dirty Harry's life.
Yeah, and it works. It just works so well, and it's not something you would think would work well. The movie is so grounded and serious. But this music comes in and gives it this kind of flair that I feel like without the score, you are missing a key component in a way that not a lot of action movies have. Like James Bond, that music has a personality. And, even Die Hard, as much as I love that movie, I mean, without the score, that movie still really, it's like you don't need the score to have that be a great movie. I mean, you could argue the same thing for Dirty Harry, but that soundtrack provides such a personality, and I absolutely adored it. Sarah, my wife, she was kind of walking in and out of the room, but she was over in the kitchen, and she just goes, "Oh my gosh, this has an amazing soundtrack." And I said, "Well, believe it or not, that's the first thing I've written down about Dirty Harry, is it's a hoppin' 70s soundtrack. Seriously, this music is great." That's my first note ever about this movie.
Well, what about the villain of the piece, Andrew Robinson's Scorpio character?
So first thing, is it just me, or does he look like exactly like Jessica Hines from Spaced?
Oh, wow. That is just you. I had not placed those two.
We need to find we need to put up a comparison image, because I swear to you, they have to be related somehow, like separated at birth or something, because as soon as he popped up on screen, I was like, is Jessica Hines in this movie? It was amazing. But I thought he was great. It was so funny, because I thought it was very interesting. I thought the whole idea of this like crazy creepy guy who's like, I'm just gonna snipe a person a day until you pay me money, is such a great hook right from the get-go. You have this very immediate threat, very palpable threat. And he was very, it worked for me. It felt very like, okay, so if Jessica Hines had a baby with Alex, Malcolm McDowell from Clockwork Orange, I feel like that would be this character. And he has this kind of creepy menace about him. It's almost like a precursor to Heath Ledger's Joker in a way. He's a little more manic. Like Joker felt a little bit more like controlled. This guy's a little more out of his mind. And I loved when he gets stabbed by Callahan.
Yes,
that scream that he lets out.
Where the all squeal. Of a sudden
he switches from being like this very like creepy. He's been in control this whole time, and then Callahan gets the upper hand, and that squeal is like the totally representative of the moment where he goes from being like very cool and like terrifying to like, oh my God, get away from me, and then he kind of recovers at the end when he gets free and he gets the upper hand on Callahan, which, by the way, I realized as I was watching it, that was spoiled for me by the television show Freaks and Geeks, because they joke about it. They talk about how like, oh, yeah, the Dirty Harry movie where he tries the bad guy pins it on him and says it was Callahan. I realized, I was like, oh, Freaks and Geeks is referencing this. This is fantastic.
That scene has to certainly be the ugliest moment in the entire movie, where he's paid underworld thug to smash his face with his leather gloved fists. It is such an ugly moment, and Robinson is such a grotesque throughout the entire movie. He's a grotesque.
Yeah.
But he's totally unshakable. You watch this movie and, you know, I'll be eating dinner and I'll see his expression from the climax of the movie when he's staring down the barrel of his gun, or the squeal moment, because of that crazy red ski mask and how his lips just sort of protrude through the mouthpiece in the most like Halloween mask fashion.
He reminded me a lot of, I don't remember the actor's name, but it was the guy in The Warriors Come Out to Play. Yeah. He had that kind of...
Yeah, David Patrick Kelly.
Yeah, he had that strong personality where it's like this guy is like super wimpy, but there's something about him that really gets under your skin and is so memorable. It was very reminiscent of that, and it was also reminiscent of Jessica Hines. I need this to become a thing. I need people to realize, to look at this and make it a thing. I loved one of my favorite things in the movie was the middle sequence where Callahan is running from payphone to payphone and trying to keep up with his game. I thought that was so great. It was such a great moment. The whole movie was really keeping me on the edge of my seat. And for a while, I was trying to figure out where it was going, because they kind of establish early on the threat of Scorpio. But then it kind of becomes a series of vignettes where it's like, here's Harry on the job and he's got his new partner, Chico, who, by the way, I like Chico a lot. And I was kind of bummed that they didn't have like a concluding moment together. Like Chico kind of saves his life, but then he gets shot and he's out for the rest of the movie and you don't see him again. And I liked that character a lot. I almost wanted a tiny moment with the two of them close to the end of the movie where it's like, yeah, I got him. I got him for you, Chico.
Yeah, but the thing is, the moment he tells Harry that he's not going to come back to the Force, he's no longer part of his life.
Like, it's true.
He's tied to the badge. And once you're out of that circle, you mean nothing to Harry.
True. And I loved their partnership. I loved kind of the frankness. It's that early, like that non-political correct frankness that movies from like the 70s and 80s have, where they're just basically like, oh, are you sure you want to work with a Mexican? And he's like, yeah, they're my least favorite, wink wink. And it was like a joke line and it was so funny, and I was like, man, if this movie came out today, no one would be happy.
No, not at all. That other cop, the fat cop who goes with Harry to the stadium at the midpoint of the movie, that's Robert Mitchum's brother.
Robert Mitchum. Why does that sound so familiar to me?
Robert Mitchum's like a classic noir actor. He did Out of the Past.
Okay.
One of my favorite 80s movies, The Yakuza.
Okay.
And apparently he had a younger brother who did bit parts in movies. And
this was one of
them.
That's
Robert Mitchum's brother.
That's so funny. There were a couple moments in this movie, like stylistic choices, that were so baffling to me. And one of them was there's a hard cut. So after Callahan goes through the whole spiel where he finds out that Scorpio is going to get out, basically because the law is protecting him, because Callahan didn't get a search warrant for him, didn't read him his Miranda rights, blah, blah, blah. The law is going to basically work against Callahan to get Scorpio back on the streets. And Callahan, he goes to a playground and he's watching children and he's kind of like being very thoughtful. And then it hard cuts to a strip bar. And it was such a like, oh my God, wait, what just happened? I thought that was so hysterical. I that was one of my favorite moments of the entire, just a very little, it's a random edit in the movie, but that was one of my absolute favorite moments because it caught me completely by surprise.
There's that scene also where they're tracking a guy with a tan suitcase that might be the Scorpio killer. And then Harry tracks him through down an alleyway, and then he watches him go into an apartment. And then he's now peeping on this guy and this girl right before they're about to have sex.
But there's this whole thing. Like, there's this undercurrent of like, is that because Chico makes a joke. He's like, now I know why they call you Dirty Harry. But there is an undercurrent of that where he's like, he's kind of like a sleazeball.
Yeah. I think he's super kinky in that moment. I think he found himself looking at a naked lady and he's like, okay, this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to watch this.
And then, when they're on the rooftop and again, he spots a naked woman and he's like, well, I got to take what I can get. And it's like, wait a second, what? You're on the job. You're supposed to be keeping an eye out for Scorpio.
Well, you know, it's that Martin Riggs thing from Lethal Weapon. You know, he has the wife who died in a tragic car accident, and you know, once she's left his life, he
all
has
bets
no
are off
for romance, and so he's got to take his nudity where he can get
that's right, exactly right. So what moments, so when was the last time you watched this? Is there anything that stood out to you, like as far as from the last time you watched it versus now, like is there anything you've picked up this time around that really stood out that hadn't before?
Well, I thought I had watched it like a couple of years ago, but then when I went to Letterboxd it today, it was not already listed in the films that I had consumed.
Oh, wow.
And I've been on Letterboxd for 3 years, so it's been at least 3 years since I've seen the film. And I had an absolute blast watching this again. I think anything new, I think what I was really taken with this time was that the fact that the film descends into the night and into the inky blacks, and the cinematography of Bruce Surtees, I was really taken with.
Yeah.
But, oh, you know, and the scene, my absolute favorite scene in the entire movie is when he and Mitchum's brother track Scorpio through the football field. They get that hot tip from the doctor and they, you know, they just say like, well, we can't just bust in here, Harry, we need a warrant. And he goes, well, I guess I'll just climb over this fence then.
I loved, there's a great shot of of Callahan when the lights when the lights first come on and he's got his gun, and it was just like, man, this is some good filmmaking. And I still,
that's,
you know,
a wallpaper moment.
It really is. And I it is such a fantastic moment, and I love just the pure rage in Eastwood's face as he finally like gets the upper hand on this guy and gets him down, and basically the guy's like pleading for his life and Callahan's like, I don't care. I just don't care.
He has to find the girl, right? You know, she's buried in a hole somewhere losing oxygen. And my favorite shot in the entire film is he steps on Scorpio's knife wound in his leg. And as Scorpio screams, there's a helicopter shot that pulls back.
Yes.
And then you see these two, you know, killers in the middle of this gladiatorial field. And that is just a gorgeous cinematic moment.
It's a really, it's an intense moment, and that like really dramatic, because the film, there are some pretty dramatic, like there's some dramatic camera moves, some dramatic cinematography, but for the most part, it's relatively tame. So whenever you do get a moment like that helicopter shot, it really stands out and it really emphasizes just what's happening in that moment. But I'm right there with you. That was one of my favorite scenes. I really loved, like I said, I loved the sequence of just him like running from phone to phone. There was just the, you know, that urgency that that created. I just loved, I feel like I've seen that bit in a lot of films, and it always works for me, but I just loved him knocking the old man out of the way when he's like, "I wait, why is the phone ringing?" And he's like, "Get out of my way. I've got a phone call. Don't answer that." But I really loved that. I mean, him standing on the bridge when the school bus comes over the hill. What a fantastic like hero shot. I was watching, I'm sure in some of the wide shots, it's a stuntman, but it looked like Eastwood was performing those stunts.
Sean, there are no stuntmen in that sequence. Eastwood shot that entire scene. The scene where, you know, that bus is not doing like 30 miles per hour with Eastwood on the top. It's flying through that quarry. And that is Eastwood hanging on for dear life.
I was going to say, I was like, this is definitely him jumping down because they have it close on him.
Yeah,
they don't try to cut away and make it look like, oh, now it's Eastwood. They keep that shot on him and his face is right in front of the camera. So I was like, oh my God. So he definitely did that jump. And then even in the wider shots, I was like, that looks a lot like Eastwood. That's incredible.
You can't fake that hair.
No, you can't. It's true. And it doesn't surprise me at all because I feel like he'd already gotten used to kind of getting beat up and having to do that with like Leone. I feel like he had to suffer through a lot on that movie, and maybe by that point, by this point, he was just kind of like, whatever, jumping off a bridge onto a bus, no big deal. I've suffered, I can do it.
And Andrew Robinson in that scene inside the bus with those kids doing old McDonald, that scene, he is so terrifying because he is like scream crying at those children.
Yeah.
And you think he's breaking down, but then he'll talk to the bus driver with like a totally normal, well, a totally psychotic, quiet voice.
Yeah.
The way he switches personas for the bus driver and the kids is really phenomenal.
Oh, I love that. And he gets right in those kids' faces too. I don't know how much acting was happening on the part of the children in that moment. Like when he slapped that kid in the face, I was like, oh my God. And the kid, like, it was like, did he just smack that child? Did that really happen? That didn't look like he pulled his slap at all. I know he's not slapping children, but I don't know. But it's the 70s.
I believe his cry for mommy for sure.
I enjoyed this movie so much. I can't think of anything else to add to the table. I would just say, let's go ahead and rate it on a scale of 1 to 5. How many 44 Magnums would you give Dirty Harry?
Well, I mean, I've already told you that this is one of my all-time favorite films. I give this 5 stars. I just rated it on Letterboxd today. 5 stars, easy. Because of the performances, that era in cinema, you know, the cinematography, Don Siegel's direction, Lalo Schifrin's score. It's like a perfect film for what it is trying to be. And I appreciate its ugliness.
Mm-hmm. I completely agree with you there. I'll go ahead after this first viewing. I think I'm going to give it 3.5, borderline 4. And a lot of it is I think you're absolutely right. This movie is for what it is absolutely perfect. I think if I'm going to knock it for anything, the simplicity of it and just kind of the general, it's very straightforward. There's not a whole lot of subtext to it, and it's not a bad thing. This movie does exactly what it needs to do. So really, I'm just kind of nitpicking, but I have a feeling that, like you, this movie is, I mean, it hasn't left my mind since I watched it. It's got so many great moments, and I'm even though I hear the sequels, like you were saying, it's a case of diminishing returns, I'm completely on board to keep at it and keep going through this series and make that happen. This movie has hooked me, and I have a feeling time is going to be kind to it for me.
Well, I'd be curious to get your reaction to the sequels. I also watched Magnum Force today, and Magnum Force is a direct response to the criticisms of Dirty Harry being too vigilante, and so they pit him against some real mean vigilantes in the sequel. And it's not quite as good. And, you know, Ted Post comes on to direct, and he's no Don Siegel.
Yeah, it's tough when you have a movie like this that's so raw and is so like just like gritty. there's always going to be a backlash. And whenever you make a sequel to that, it's difficult to recapture that kind of same momentum, that same feeling, especially if, like you said, they're kind of looking at it as like, oh, how can we correct the mistakes of the past? It's almost like you have to admire a movie like Dirty Harry for just doing it and getting out there and getting made at all.
Well, and you know, this film ends with Harry tossing his badge into that lake. And
yeah.
So when he comes back in the sequels, I mean, what happened? Did he dive in and change his mind and collect it again?
That's what I want to know. Because, yeah, I got to. That's what I feel like the first shot of Magnum Force is him leaping into the water after his badge. He's like, I changed my mind. There has to be a sequel. I love movies where they were not planning for a sequel at all. And then they kind of have to very quickly be like, but just kidding. So yeah, like Rocky 1 and Rocky 2 is a perfect example with the ball. Like, there ain't going to be no rematch. And then the opening scene is, let's have a rematch right now. So yeah, someday I'm absolutely excited. And, like I said, this movie, it's so effective. It's so well made. It's awesome. I definitely would recommend it to people who haven't seen it. And I'm glad I got a chance to finally see it, that you gave me an excuse to watch it. And, I'm thrilled that we could talk about it.
Yeah, thanks for having me on to chat up one of my favorite films and rediscover or reaffirm why it is one of my favorite films.
Absolutely. And we want to hear from you on Twitter and the Facebooks. On the Twitter and the Facebooks, tell us what you think. I'm at Yay Sean Dorman. I want to hear, like, have you seen the Dirty Harry movies? What do you think? Do they still hold up for you? How do you feel about the sequels? And Brad, where can people find you on the social medias?
You can find me on Twitter at MouthDork. And of course, you can find me the ItModcast on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, all the hot places.
Definitely go check that out because it's fantastic. And we want to thank you for listening to this episode. If you like what you're hearing, give us a 5-star rating wherever you might be listening. Rate the crap out of us. That would be awesome. But good ratings, all happy ratings. So that's it. I think my day has been made. I know that quote isn't in this movie, but my day was made. Thank you, Mr. Eastwood.